not really satisfied. I didn't feel great, just good, but yeah, too soon in the TT it started to hurt, and it was a long way to the finish, so yeah, I don't know really the result. I think I finished quite short still, but yeah, the feeling was not how I hoped for. Yeah, first I went to see the GC because I was also thinking about the red jersey, so yeah, if I'm still close, I still want to give it a shot in the next days, and for sure the next 2 days we try to go for the sprint.
You're 2 seconds behind, third position, 2 seconds.
Oh, yeah, then all is to play, so that's good.
Buon tarde, Fran Reyes.
Daniel Friva.
We're in Portugal. Fran, what a view, what a setting, what a scene. You were excited about tonight. You were promising me all day that you would find the most wonderful location, and you have exceeded my expectations. Fran, last year in the podcast, we used to end our episodes with some wistful gazing from you. Don't get too wistful, because it's the start of a new adventure for both of us, but just describe at least the scene.
So the landscape is exactly the one that I was dreaming of. When I woke up this morning, I told and I sent you this message saying, Daniel, if we could get a table just in front of the sea, taking advantage that the race is finishing right in the coast, it would be great. On a nice bar on which we were sitting on stools and with some glasses of wine. In that regard, we have changed a bit the tone, because we are not in stools but on simple chairs, and we are not drinking wine but beer. 0.0 beer in your case, which is something a bit offensive to my Spanish
to your sensibilities.
Culture, you know?
We've got the Superbock, of course. Superbock is the it's the beer, I think. Superbock, oh no, maybe Superbock is from Porto. Yeah. And Sagres is from south of Lisbon, I know that. Anyway, there are two main beers in Portugal, one Sagres, one Superbock. I'm drinking the non-alcoholic Superbock. Fran, I neglected to mention that the first voice we heard tonight, before our listeners heard from you and from me, was Wout van Aert. He was one of the beaten men, and one of the big stories, if not the big story, in today's opening curtain-raising time trial in this Vuelta a España. We have established that he was beaten. We're going to find out who beat him, shall we? It's time for the first tale of the etapa, of a resumen de la etapa of the 2024 Vuelta a España.
El resumen de la etapa, the tale of the etapa.
Stage one of the 2024 Vuelta a España was an individual time trial which took the 176 riders of the Vuelta from Lisbon to Oeiras, which is where we are, Fran. I hope we mentioned that. I think we mentioned that. Gazing out over the Atlantic. There's some. We talked in the preview about how there might be some fellas on the other side of that body of water who might be. They might be keen to have a few conversations with you, Fran, given your nickname and your reputation. Precede you. We are in Oeiras. The weather conditions today were very hot, over 30 degrees, and very windy, with gusts of up to 40 kilometers an hour from the north. First rider down the start ramp in Belém, outside or opposite the Monument of the Discoveries, was the Lynx of Marbella, Luis Ángel Mate. More about that big cat later on. But the first real marker was laid down by the Italian Eduardo Affini, because he took 12 minutes and 43 seconds and rode at an average speed of 56.6 kilometers an hour. And also remain on the hot seat deep into the early evening, an extremely hot seat today. Meanwhile, we saw some impressive performances, for example, by Florian Lipovits, who lost just 13 seconds, and some less impressive ones. For example, Mikel Landa. Fran, how much did Mikel Landa lose? We're going to talk about some GC riders in a minute.
1:05 to McNulty, which makes only 50 seconds compared to Primoz Roglic, who is, so to say, the landmark between the overall riders.
Mikel Landa, more teabag than T-Rex today, if that's not slightly unfair. And when Affini was finally ousted, it was by a surprising name, Fran, Matthias Vacek, the little Trek rider, a Czech little Trek rider who went 5 seconds faster than Affini. Many had expected Josh Tarling to take first place, but he had already finished by this point and he was fractions of a second outside Affini's time. And he was a very disappointed young man, as we'll find out later. By now, the big guns were out on the course, and we saw Wout van Aert go quicker than Vacek at the first time check, and Brandon McNulty was third at the first time check. Big shock, though, colpa di scena, as they say in Italy, those positions were reversed by the time they reached the finish line. As Brandon McNulty rose like a phoenix, of course, he hails from Phoenix in the United States, to take UAE's 65th victory of the season, and van Aert ended up third. Fran, I'm going to read out the final standings now. In fact, McNulty, stage winner, and in the Maillot Rojo, the red jersey, tonight. Second, Vacek, 2 seconds down. Wout van Aert, who we've already heard from, third. He was 2 seconds down as well, but slightly slower than Vacek. Stefan Kung, another disappointing outcome for him. Not a disappointing performance. He was 6 seconds down. Affini, fifth, 7 seconds. Tarling, sixth, 8 seconds adrift of McNulty. Seventh, Mauro Schmidt of Jayco Alula, 16 seconds down. Eighth, a good performance by Primoz Roglic, also 16 seconds down. Bruno Armirail, 18 seconds down in ninth. And in tenth, the home hero, Joao Almeida. Fran, that was the stage, but of course, at Grand Tours, there are always two stories. Who won the stage and what happened to the GC riders? You're going to give us a bit of a virtual general classification of all of the riders that we think might have something to say on the general classification in this Vuelta a España.
Yeah, so we have Roglic in first position of those standings, 3 seconds in arrears. We find Joao Almeida from UAE, while Ezequiel Moser would be 6 seconds back, Antonio Tiveri from Bahrain Victorious 10 seconds back, Daniel Felipe Martinez at 17, Adam Yates at 18, Enric Mas. Decent performance for Enric Mas. I was pleasantly surprised. 23 seconds back. Richard Carapaz at 24. Carlos Rodriguez at 29. Ben O'Connor. I was asking you whether we consider him a GC candidate or not.
He's got a lovely spreadsheet that he's knocked up in double quick time here. He's got them in finishing order, all these general classification riders. This is an impressive body of work that you put together, Fran. Anyone, go on.
So Ben O'Connor is 36 seconds behind Primoz Roglic, while Sepp Kuss, defending champion, is 37. And Mikel Landa, which is the final guy in this virtual GC of the cycling podcast, is 49 seconds behind Primoz Roglic.
I'm going to take issue, Fran, with your virtual general classification. You have omitted Theo Gegenhardt, who I thought did a very good ride today. He was 26th. Of course, he crashed out of the Vuelta a Burgos a couple of weeks ago, 31 seconds down. Adam Yates, you mentioned? You did mention Adam Yates? Yeah, 34 seconds. Max Poole? 37 seconds down in 31st place. Anyone? I mean, there are lots of riders you could sort of lump in there, you could throw in there, couldn't you? Fran, we're going to talk in detail about the general classification riders and what today told us about the general classification in part two. But what I would like from you now is one name, one rider, one GC rider whose stock has risen, who had a good day. Whose stock has risen after today's time trial?
I would say Matthias Ezequiel Moser from Little Trek, because for such a small guy as he relatively is, being 13th in a time trial that was basically about watts and aerodynamics, being 13th and losing only 8 seconds to Roglic and 22 to the winner of the day, is an astounding performance. He has been preparing very well for this Vuelta. It was the main target of his season, and it has started to pay off already on the first day.
Stock falling. Whose stock has fallen, Fran?
there was someone who was going to rock off the charts as soon as the first pedal stroke was given, and it was Nairo Quintana, because a Movistar team, they actually thought that he had to be there.
Let's not party like it's 2017. I don't think even the most ardent Nairo Man fan considers him to be one of the favourites for this Vuelta a España. So I'm not having that. Come on, give me another name. Someone else who we genuinely think could trouble the sort of top five.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say if someone has underperformed, we could say it's Carlos Rodriguez, because he had been pretty solid in previous TTs. But even for his standards, I think he was where he had to be.
Remind us how many seconds he lost.
Yeah, he lost 46 seconds to McNulty. That makes 30 seconds to Primoz Roglic. So he's basically still in the mix. The gaps had not been too big because of how fast the TT has been. So pretty much I would say that everyone is even.
Fran, at this point, traditionally in these Grand Tour podcasts, we hear from some of the protagonists of the day's stage. As I said earlier, we've already heard from Wout Van Aert, who was a slightly disappointed man. However, and there was a caveat to that. He's only 3 seconds adrift of Brandon McNulty, and he said tonight he was going to go for the sprint tomorrow. He's going to go for the stage win tomorrow. So he's got a really good chance, I would suggest, taking that red jersey. It's not going to, I would say, in spite of the big rivalry that exists between UAE Team Emirates and Visma Lisa Bike, it won't upset UAE Emirates too much if Van Aert takes the jersey tomorrow. So we've already heard from Van Aert. Fran, at this point, I propose that we hear from Josh Tarling, who had very high hopes of taking that first red jersey. Another rider who has sort of serially been disappointed in big time trials over the last few seasons, and that is Stefan Kung of Groupama FDJ. He was fourth, 6 seconds behind McNulty, and you'll hear him in the interview, but I sort of watched his body language when he heard that Vacek had beaten him. And Fran, if you remember the famous clip that went viral of Remco Evenepoel after the time trial in Australia, it was kind of similar to that. Not to sort of belittle Vacek or to suggest that Vacek wasn't worthy of first place, but you're going to hear Kung say, "There's always someone who beats me." And then finally, Fran, we're going to hear one of the riders. We're going to hear, I think, the rider who finished first today. And first, I don't mean he is on top of the rankings at the end of the day, but he was the first rider to cross the line today. And of course, it's his last Vuelta a España. I'm talking about none other than the Lynx of Marbella. We're going to be hearing a lot from in this Vuelta a España. So, Tarling, Kung, and Luis Angel Mate.
Terrible. I just felt so bad, really. Not to take away from Afini's really good ride, but I just felt flat. I struggled like the week in between Olympics and this. I just felt really just like a brick.
Can you find an answer or why you were feeling like that?
I honestly don't know. I just feel a bit heavy and a bit lost, really. Like I said, I struggled after the Olympics, head-wise and training-wise, and I thought I was on it and confident today, but got going and just sunk a bit. I wasted my opportunity today, so I think I'm going to really try and step up for the team and help Johnny and Duplus and Timon and Carlos and whoever I need, and do the best, I think, with this wind and stuff. I can be help, especially tomorrow along the coast, so yeah.
There's always someone. Holy shit. I thought Tarling was going to be the man to beat. I beat him, but someone else was faster, so I have to accept the verdict. Wow, sometimes I had really crazy gusts. like, honestly, I was scared sometimes, especially in the downhill after the little climb. I was going 77 km/h and I was just like praying that nothing happens. But yeah, especially in the first half, the gusts were really crazy and I had trouble of staying upright and staying in position and keep pushing power.
Stefan, you said there's always someone. Today was Vacek. Was that a surprise to you? You looked a little bit surprised.
Yeah, because before the race you have like pre-race favorites that you think you have to beat, and for me they were like really Wout and Tarling. But yeah, on a time trial like this everything can happen, and yeah, congrats to Matthias.
How are you dealing with all these near misses? Like you say, always someone. It must be really difficult mentally.
Yeah, because I mean, in the end, I have a super nice career. I achieved a lot, but until now, I have the feeling I'm remembered as the guy who almost made it. And yeah, I would really like to change this, but there's 20 stages to go. I'm in good shape. I feel good again on the bike. So for sure today I will be a little bit bummed, but I'm still motivated and looking forward to the rest of the Vuelta.
Luis Angel Mate, we knew that this was going to be an important Vuelta for you. It's the last race as a professional, but it's already an important race because you were leading the time trial.
Yeah, for sure. When I passed the finish line, I show the time. Leader for one time, eh? Arbitro, tiempo, time, annulé. Yeah, for me it's a for sure special one because it's the last one. When I was young, I never can imagine this my career, this kind of finish my career, and I'm really really happy to be here, to be in good form and try to enjoy every minute, every kilometer and every moment with you, with the people, with the teammates, with the college, with everybody.
And we're in Portugal. You have a special, you've developed this special relationship in Portugal. Last 2 years in the Volta Portugal, 2 stage wins.
I love Portugal. I love the people. I love the culture. I love their food, their everybody. I really like it. Portugal is our country, is our Iberian country, and I'm really happy to be here. I think it's a special moment also for Portugal cyclists because sometimes don't watch a lot of the Portugal youngs, and they are really really good cyclists.
We'll talk to you more about Portugal in the next few days, Luis, but this being your last race, there's some pressure in a way to enjoy it or to make it a special race, also because we're in Andalusia. What spirit are you taking? What kind of attitude are you trying to take into this last Vuelta? And you've got to do 61,000 meters of climbing, so it's not a walk in the park.
Not easy. I'm really nervous. I'm really nervous like the first time, because for me it's the special one. It's the special one Vuelta, and hardest also, because I think the most hardest week is the second week in Galicia, but also in Andalusia with this weather, you know, with these steep climbs, and nothing. I try to do my best. I try to enjoy every moment, and I hope to be protagonist someday. Why not?
And you're in good form, you said.
Yes, for sure. I do Vuelta Portugal. After Portugal, a little bit rest in altitude in Sierra Nevada. And yeah, now in this new cycling, you can measure all with the numbers. Yeah. The numbers are good, and I hope to be in the form someday. Why not?
How many watts per kilo are you doing these days? 20 minutes.
This is a secret. This is I can't say to you that. I don't know because I don't have power meter in the TT bike.
Oh, no. Luis, can you win the Vuelta?
For sure.
Tomorrow we go to Fatima. There's a famous miracle, Milagro in Fatima. Luis Angel Mate winning the Vuelta.
Why not? Also, Vuelta Portugal pass in Fatima.
Chris Horner was older than you are now when we won the Vuelta.
Why not? Why not?
The cycling podcast is supported by a map.
So, Fran, before the little commercial interlude there, we heard from two very disappointed riders, Josh Tarling, one exceedingly disappointed rider in Josh Tarling, Stefan Kung, and a sort of elated rider in Luis Angel Mate, a very excited rider, but as we heard there, nervous as well about what the next month is going to bring for him, what it's going to mean for him, because, you know, I guess it puts a special kind of pressure on a rider when he announces, and particularly a rider like Luis Angel Mate, who's a bit of a sort of folk hero. He's a very popular rider, and people expect, you know, they don't expect him to win the Vuelta, although I suggested there that we might see another miracle of Fatima, more about Fatima later, and maybe he will win the Vuelta. But there's sort of this expectation that sentimentally, emotionally, we all hope on his behalf that it's going to be this fantastic journey, and I think he feels quite a lot of pressure today. But just going back to the first couple, Josh Tarling and Stefan Kung, both of those riders were very much in the thick of the action at the Olympics, in the Olympic time trial, as was Wout Van Aert. It was interesting, I heard quite a few riders who had ridden in the Olympics and the Olympic time trial today talk about not feeling very good, and as though after the Olympics they'd felt a sense of anticlimax and it was kind of difficult to get themselves up again. Of course, Brandon McNulty experienced the opposite because he was fifth in the Olympic time trial, just 1 minute and 4 seconds behind Remco Evenepoel. And he sits on top of the throne tonight, Fran.
Yeah. It's also, you know, I believe it is also about the energy with which you approach the main goal of your season. In the case of McNulty, we know that he had targeted the Olympics from the very beginning, that the team was agreed with that and was very
supportive. That's why he didn't do the tour, isn't it?
Yeah, he didn't do the tour, he didn't do the Giro. His whole program was focused on the Olympics and then going to the Vuelta on a support role. He had worked with the performance staff of UAE in order to streamline every detail in his time trialing, and in the end, the bet has paid off because he was aiming for top five on the Olympics, and he was fifth indeed, so he scored the result he was aiming for. And then in this Vuelta, starting with a win, just puts the whole team in a positive vibe, on a positive mood that can go forward. Also, UAE, they have plenty of reasons to be happy for today. They put both their GC riders on decent positions. Also, Isaac Del Toro, my personal favorite underdog of this Vuelta, is well placed as well.
Can I say, I thought there would be more UAE riders in the top 10. I do have to remind you at this point, Fran, that I think João Almeida was your outside tip to win today.
Yes,
and
he
finished 10th.
And he still is, you know.
No, to win today.
I still stand by my bet that he was going to win today. I'm proud of that.
19 seconds, João Almeida. I mean, he was the crowd favourite. He got the biggest reception when he came over the line. Incidentally, in Oeiras, I mean, the crowds today weren't huge on the course, were they? There were a lot of people at the start. A beautiful start in Belém, as we said, in the museum district of Lisbon. On the route itself, not so many. And here in Oeiras, you had the sense that, well, it's a Saturday. The weather is beautiful, as I said, very hot, a lot of people on the beach, and it was a short walk from the beach to where the time trial
and
was.
A lot of shirtless fans, you know, a lot of fans that were not sporting any shirt or t-shirt whatsoever, which is something very Vuelta-like, you know, because in the Vuelta we have all these coastal finishes on which people just leaves their staff on the beach and approach the finish line to see the riders go by. And that's, you know, that's quite endemic in it. That doesn't happen in Deutschland Tour.
It doesn't. Fran, before we go on to talk about general classification riders in more detail, just a word on Vacek. It was a surprise that he finished second, but a lot of people have seen this coming from him. He's not necessarily a time trial specialist. He's had good results in time trials in the past, top 10s, top 5s, top 3s. But the feeling has been for a while that this is a guy, and he's 22 years of age. He's been a professional for quite a long time. Of course, he was a victim of the fallout with Gazprom when that team exploded, when the conflict broke out in Ukraine a couple of years ago. But it feels as though he's been a professional for a long time. So, and the perception is that he's not, you know, a sort of new kid on the block. But 22 years of age, it does seem as though he is on the threshold of a big breakthrough.
Mm-hmm. I believe that Matthias Vlasic is bound to become a sort of newer version of Wout van Aert, you know, a powerful all-rounder that can sprint as well as time trial, that can be very useful for the team when performing a team duty, and also a very good classics rider. We are actually going through to visit his home during this Vuelta, because he happens to live in Motril, which is the start of stage 9. Both him as his brother Karel. Do you remember Karel Vlasic? I mean, he was the big rival of Remco Evenepoel back in their junior years. Yeah. You know, I remember that when Remco won the Worlds in Innsbruck, Vlasic was disappointed in the mix zone, saying that had he not gotten cramps in the descent after the last climb, he would have beaten Evenepoel. Yet afterwards, he had a quite underwhelming development of his career, and right now he's racing for Burgos PH and not doing so well. Yet Matthias is confirming that trend that younger brothers tend to be better athletes than their elders.
I'm slightly traumatized whenever I have to talk about Czech riders, Fran, because you know we have to refer to it as Czechia now, not the Czech Republic. And that introduces doubts into my mind, even about the adjective. We can still call them Czechs, can't we?
Even though Czech is good.
It's still good. Yeah. Fran, you mentioned his sprinting abilities. Is he a threat to Van Aert tomorrow? We talked about Van Aert probably going to take, well, we said they would probably take the red jersey tomorrow because he is only 3 seconds behind, and you know, he doesn't even have to win the stage tomorrow. But Vlasic could sort of thwart him, couldn't he?
Yes, he stands a chance of getting victory tomorrow. I mean, we have only one pure world-class sprinter in this Vuelta, which is Caden Groves, and then we have these two powerful riders in Van Aert and Vlasic that can sprint from the wind. And taking into account the profile of the different sprint stages that we have on this Vuelta, which is always lumpy coming into the finish, there is only one single really flat run in, which is Sevilla, stage 5. So I think that all plays in favor of these powerful riders that are maybe a bit more versatile than Groves, who on pure speed should be superior to them.
I'm just looking at his sprinting CV, Fran Vlasic. The Tour of Norway is probably not a bad gauge. He had a fifth there, a fourth, an eighth. Who was he sprinting against? He was sprinting against some fast guys, not the very fastest guys in the peloton. I think it's going to be difficult for him, but he should not be underestimated. Fran, we will now talk more about the riders who we consider to be favourites to win this Vuelta a España before we arrived in Lisbon, in my case, yesterday. Primoz Roglic, he'll be a pretty happy man. He was smiling at the finish. We didn't get to talk to him. We did hear him have a brief exchange with his wife, who was in the team car. I don't think Primoz knew that she was in the team car. And when he saw her, he said, "Oh, if I'd known that you were there, I would have gone even faster." But I don't know about you, but I've seen Primoz Roglic after quite a number of time trials in the last couple of years, and he always seems very relieved that it hasn't been a complete disaster. And that's the way that Primoz Roglic seems. I can really identify him, actually. He seems to be relieved when a day doesn't turn into a complete disaster. I mean, just on that, I think it's been reported, it's been documented, that he was late for the team presentation a couple of days ago. He arrived, or he ended up being presented on his own because his Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe teammates had already gone up. How this came about? Well, there was a mix-up over times. They were initially early, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. They came down to the team presentation and they were told, "No, you shouldn't be here. You should come in an hour." And they then rode back to their hotel a short distance away. And then I think the time was changed again, and they were told half an hour. And then there was a search party sent out for Primoz to tell him no, there'd been another change, and there was a knock on his door, and he was sort of, you know, he was not ready, shall we say, to head to the team presentation. And then he did finally make it, 2 minutes and 45 seconds after his teammates. I did look up Fran. The most famous case of a rider being late for something in cycling was Pedro Delgado in the prologue in the 1989 Tour de France. Delgado was 2 minutes 40 seconds late on that occasion. Just on Calamity Primoz, he alarmed a lot of his fans yesterday by posting a picture he was sort of smiling or grimacing or gurning at the camera, showing all of his gnashes, well, except one gnasher, which was missing. He was missing a tooth. And the caption was something which suggested, or it was not a great start, something along those lines, which people assumed to mean he'd probably crashed again in training. That was not the case. He apparently had been having issues with an implant for a while, and he'd been at altitude for the whole period before the Vuelta a España. There were no dentists wherever they were. They were on the Isérons in France, weren't they? There were no dentists in the Haute Alpes. So he sort of booked himself in for an intervention here in Lisbon. But after all of that, he had a pretty good day. And Fran, I mean, I heard from his team today, just at the start, talking to sort of people in the know. He has been going well in training. The numbers have been good. But he has been quite cautious in telling everyone in the team that he really didn't know whether his back was going to hurt until he had to do an all-out effort. And he said even the all-out efforts in training are not really a good guide, a good gauge of how his back was going to feel. As I say, we didn't speak to him after today's time trial. We don't know how he felt, but he certainly rode pretty well.
Mm-hmm. So you said you saw him smiling?
Yes.
And does he got the implant replaced, or does he have an empty space?
I didn't notice that.
Because, you know, I was today, my obsession was finding out how many teeth were rider using today the time trial in their bikes, and we had the 68 for Charlin, 62 for the UAE guys, including McNulty, and 64 minus one for Roglic.
64 minus one.
Minus one, yeah, of course. The one that he got removed on the dentist.
You know? How many teeth does the average person have in their mouth?
That's a very good question. Maybe we should have asked a dentist beforehand.
As I look it up, how many do you think?
I would say 36.
32 permanent teeth. It's a bit like the sprocket you would need for the Angliru or the Kutu Negru earlier. later in this Vuelta a España. So Fran, Roglic really, well, I don't think he really told us either way what kind of form he's in or what we should expect from him over the next few days. I said in our preview that I always consider these short time trials to be significant and to tell us quite a lot. Mm-hmm. We've already sort of established, or you suggested when you gave us the virtual TT, that maybe today didn't tell us that much.
No, because it was a flying TT, you know. Of course, it was pretty straightforward because there were nearly no technical challenges in the course, and it was about finding your top speed and keeping it all the way to the finish. Indeed, riders did benefit from some tailwinds, so that makes the task even easier. So once you had heard your pace, once you had heard your gear in order to develop that pace, there was not a lot of mystery around it. So I guess for riders it was of course an exhausting effort, because a TT is always exhausting, but it was not as demanding or as cutthroat as to be telling. In my opinion, what we saw here was the success of certain individuals, but no major defeat. Because even Sepp Kuss, you know, losing 36 seconds to Primoz Roglic, that could be well within the planning of anyone who had taken a guess of how the time trial would pan out.
Yeah, I think it's very hard. Just looking down, Adam Yates, we talked about how, well, I said I expected UAE to be even better today just because their time trialing has been excellent all year. And Yates is a good time trialist. but he did lose 34 seconds. That said, there couldn't be a time trial less well suited to a rider like Yates than today, could there? So, and on, you know, on the other hand, you have riders like Lipovic that I mentioned, who, well, he's not here to ride for general classification, he's here to support Roglic, but I think he probably overperformed, or he certainly overperformed my expectations for him. I think it bears repeating, Theo Gegenhardt, I think, losing 31 seconds, I think that's a really encouraging performance for his fans. Of course, he's had a kind of troubled build-up, or he's had a troubled summer with illness keeping him out of the Tour de France.
And on top of that, yesterday, on Thursday, on the team presentation, he got mistaken for another rider, you know?
Sam Omen. Was it
Sam
Omen?
Yeah, exactly. They asked Sam Omen instead of him the questions that what actually meant for Theo, which is a heartful omission and came on the back of a press conference on which they asked him whether he was ever going to contend for GC again. And he seemed pretty pissed about it, you know, he seemed pretty pissed about it, and it's understandable because he has been undergoing so many difficulties. And last year, he was taking off again to become the rider that he was 3 or 4 years ago. He got that awful crash at the Giro. So I understand that he is upset, and I understand that even if he has things to prove, what he might need right now, it's more a peace of mind and a reassuring performance, maybe racing in support of Esquil Mosa. Mm.
Fran, we are mulling over, we're meditating on the extent to which today told us anything about the general classification. We are going to now think about the defending champion, Sepp Kuss, and his chances in this Vuelta a España. And incidentally, I asked him after the finish, we're going to hear it now, whether today was any kind of truth serum, whether it told us anything about what we're going to see over the next 3 weeks. Here's Sepp Kuss answering that question after the finish.
Would today be a decent sort of truth serum of everyone's form? Would it tell us much about people's form?
It's hard to say. I mean, it's so early and such a unique point of the race so early on, so short. I think the first mountain stage is more of an indicator, if that.
You didn't go for the double disc today. That would have been interesting.
Oh no, I should have gone with two training wheels to not feel the wind. But there's guys that are braver and stronger than I am.
So, Fran, Kuss, 53 seconds he lost today, won't be too alarmed. By all accounts, he's been going very well in training, which is a welcome relief after a troubled season, shall we say, Fran. Just quickly, what do you expect from Sepp Kuss in this Vuelta?
I expect him to be up there. I am not sure whether he would be consistently at the same level on every stage, because after having such a busy season as the one that he had last year in 2023, it is only normal that the body doesn't fully bounce back to the level on which he was, and I think that maybe he will struggle with consistency in this Vuelta, especially given that his rivals know that he has not been at his top shape during the whole year, and that this race offers plenty of opportunity to set a hard pace and just make racing demanding. So I think that they are going to ask a lot from him, and that might be detrimental for his chances.
Fran, I was at the Visma Lisa bike bus this morning. Well, it wasn't this morning, it was after lunchtime at the start, and it was a hive of activity, as it always is. Richard Plugger was there. Also there was a gentleman for whom this Vuelta a España represents the end of the road. It's his last bike race. I'm talking about Marijn Zeeman, who has been one of the masterminds of Visma Lisa bike, formerly Jumbo Visma, success over the last few years. And as has been reported, as he announced earlier in the year, he is abandoning the team and abandoning cycling. He's going to be working in football in the future, or from next year. He's going to join AZ Alkmaar, who are a decent Dutch football club. They're not Ajax, they're not PSV Eindhoven, but they're a solid sort of Divisie, that's Dutch First Division team. And Fran, Marijn Zeeman is the subject of the first Encuentro del Día, first meeting of the day of this Vuelta a España. We're going to hear that now. I spoke to Marijn about Sepkus, I spoke to him about Kian Uttebroeks, and the start of this interview contains references to something we'll be discussing in part three, that is the famous Portuguese delicacy, sweet dessert, snack, pastéis de nata, which are these little sort of custard tarts. So here is the Encuentro del Día with Marijn Zeeman.
El Encuentro del Día, the meeting of the day.
A moment.
Of course.
Do you taste it?
You
have to taste it.
You can. You're very welcome
okay,
if you want
tradition
one.
Traditional Portugal. Yeah. Machin already eat it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No. And he says it's good. So you have to try it.
Okay. It's a big rival. If the rivals are eating them, then you have to try one.
Yeah.
Maybe at the end of the interview.
Then I needed it. Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
Marijn, well, I understand it's your last race, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Obviously, this time last year, Sepp was beginning Vuelta that he was going to win.
Yeah.
Just sum up the year that he's had.
Yeah. Well, very difficult year. Where do I start? I'm the beginning was actually quite good. Was also in Portugal. Was in Algarve. Actually, there it was on a higher level than we were expecting, but from that moment on, he had quite some setbacks, with the highlight that actually when we were preparing the tour, of course, that he got COVID the last weekend of the Dauphiné, and actually that hit him very hard. He was not very sick from it, but just training was very bad. So that took really quite some time to come back on a normal level, and then he started preparing the Vuelta, and that actually, luckily for him, for us, that went quite well. Winning Burgos, of course, was a good confidence boost. That was. I think he's ready for a good Vuelta. Your next question is, will he go for the win?
It wasn't actually, but go on.
And that's something for us, of course, also, and for him, like something to discover. The good thing is that the big three is not here, so that will give more chances, more opportunities. But how he will be compared to 10 riders named as favorites, it's also for us a bit of a question mark. But we have good confidence that he will be there and that he can compete, and then just fight and see how high he can come. Yeah.
It's often said in sport that it's easier to prepare people for failure than it is for success.
Yeah.
Does that apply to Sepp, or has Sepp's year just been a story of misfortune? It's got nothing to do with the fact that he had that success last year.
Yeah. Yeah, good question. I mean, that's also something to reflect in the off season. Like, could we have done some things different, or did something? Are there some things to improve or do differently? Only thing what I've seen from Sepp was that he had a very good winter. That he was very dedicated and very motivated to work hard, and actually he did. So, I would say that we were expecting a very good year, but it turned out to be a little bit different. But on the other hand, the Vuelta is his favorite race, always have always been. So I really believe that he will be with the best riders. Yeah.
Last year he was a very reluctant hero, reluctant leader almost. Has that changed at all?
Yeah, well, I think his ambition this year was to be really like more of a leader. But yeah, in the end, it's also like the legs have to talk. Hopefully we will see him here as a leader. And I'm confident in that. But of course, you need to combine also your level with the way you lead a team, and you need level for that. And this year, that it wasn't meant to be yet. That's something for this race, hopefully. Yeah.
I just asked you a couple of things about Kian as well. People maybe expected unrealistically that he would just explode in this team. It hasn't really happened yet. But again, with him, how would you assess his year and his development in this first few months with your team?
The honest story, of course, is that that he didn't take another step after last year. But I think the most important thing with Kian is to realize that he's very young. And that we still have riders in our development team with his age, he needs time, and I'm very confident that he will be a leader in the coming years. I'm very confident in that. But he will need time to learn, to experience, and to progress. So that will take some time, I guess. But I'm very sure that he can do it. Yeah.
And just before I ask you one last question about yourself, just one thing on, obviously today we've got a time trial. Kian's time trialing this year, there's been a lot of attention, particularly on social media, about the fact that he hasn't seemed to improve on his Bora performances. What would you say about his time trialing so far this year?
Yeah, well, again, the honest story is he didn't progress there. So there's still really work to do, because he needs to progress, obviously, as a GC rider. But that really takes time, and that's equipment development, that's position development, that's training development.
Sometimes he started time trials well and not finished them well.
But it's a combination of keeping up the power and having the best possible aerodynamics, position wise, equipment wise, and that's a journey. That's to learn, and we are not there yet, and we are working very hard on that. But that's the same like his personal development that takes time. And again, I'm very, very confident that he will come there. But he's so young. It will come. But the reason why people are on top of it, of course, that's also like the modern time that young riders like him, the expectations are so high. He has such a long career in front of him, and it will come, but we don't rush, we take the time for that. Yeah.
He has a long career ahead of him. You don't have a long career ahead of you in this team. Last race, how does it feel?
Strange and also emotional, of course. I don't leave because I don't like it anymore, but more that I want to explore new things, and that's the reasons. But it feels strange, of course, but I will try to enjoy it now that I'm still here, and then time for new things. Yeah.
Thanks, Marijn. And do you want a pastel?
But later, because I just have lunch.
You're going to take it now?
Yeah, I'm going to take it
and
now.
Tell me, give me your verdict tomorrow. Yeah. You can take two if you want. Give Adi one.
I give also Adi,
Okay.
There you go. It's good. Yeah. Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you.
You love to travel? Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Rite of passage when you're in Lisbon, so I've heard. Pastéis de nata, these famous custard tarts, they're everywhere now. It's a very recent phenomenon, but of course they've been eating them and making them in Portugal for centuries, I hear, and it all started where I am standing currently. Pastéis de Belém, it's about 50 meters from the start line today, and this was the first place to ever make this sort of dessert tart. I don't even like custard, don't really like eggy things, never had one, so this feels like a good place to start, or at least a rite of passage that you have to do when you're here anyway.
Agárrate mi vida.
Hola. Como é que é isso de seis?
Com seis? E é tudo?
Por favor. Sim, tudo.
So put a sleeve, a pack of six, a six pack. We're having a six pack in evidence today, unfortunately. Here, they come in like this cardboard, a white cardboard sleeve, a bit like bocce. Have you seen those in Italy? I'm gonna have one now. It's kind of giving me the ick, because as I said, I really don't like eggy things, but I'm gonna try one now. We're gonna probably hear a crunch. I mean, yeah, tastes sweet, tastes eggy. No, I don't think
I'm better. For me, One, two, all in.
Queremos.
No. Thank you. No. Enjoy it, okay? Enjoy it. Yeah.
Stefan Flester. Press Chief Red Bull Bora Hans Court. Stefan, I've never had one of these before, and I've just had one now, and it's the original Pastel de Belém. So I've got nothing to compare it to. Is it a good pastel de nata?
I guess it's the best in the world. Really. It's the original one.
Jacob Tennyson, press chief. Little trek. You used to live in Lisbon, so you should be an aficionado. These are the original. Are they the best? Pastéis de Belém.
Well, personally, I prefer the pastéis de nata that aren't from Belém. I think these ones are a bit too crispy for my liking. I don't like them with cinnamon on, but I don't like cinnamon in general. Any pastel de nata is a good one, but I prefer the less crispy version.
What do the Portuguese think about them taking over the world, being ubiquitous, you being able to find them everywhere now?
I think they'd be quite happy with that. My mum works in a cafe and she sells them a lot down in Kent. They're just called custard tarts there, but they're really cropping up all over the place.
I feel like we could do an hour on the difference between a custard, an English custard tart, and a pasta de nata, but time trial's about to start. Thanks, Jacob. You enjoy the rest of that.
Thank you, Daniel.
Well, Fran, that was a taste of my adventures, my pursuit of this mythical pasta de nata, the original one, Pastel de Belém. Not the pastel de nata. You also went in pursuit of the pastel de nata. You went somewhere else.
Yeah, but I mean, in my case, the nata just found me. You know, I was having a salad with a very good friend, and afterwards I saw nata on the counter, and I told me, I want one. I absolutely want one. When I first came to Portugal on holiday with one of my former girlfriends in 2018 or 2019, we spent a whole week getting nata 2, 3, or 4 times a day, and we came home with 2 boxes full of natas. It is a really unique treat that we can find in Portugal, and one that I fancy particularly because you can eat it at any time of the day, as you were saying.
Yeah,
it's
really
both a dessert and a snack, you know.
Yeah,
it's great.
Yeah, I wasn't really able to, well, I was there at sort of 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and that place where I bought, well, the original Pastel de Belém is a bit of a tourist trap, so I didn't really know whether it being full at 3 o'clock was any kind of indication of when it's normally eaten, how it's normally eaten. And Fran, just a bit of background on the Pastel de Belém and Pastel de Nata. Created sort of first, well, they originated from the Hieronymus monastery in Belém in the 17th century. Convents and monasteries used to use a lot of egg whites, Fran, to starch friars and nuns' habits, as their robes, basically. And the yolks, the leftover yolks, were then used to make various sort of cakes, not just what we now know as pastel de nata. In the aftermath of the liberal revolution of 1820, following the dissolution of religious orders, facing impending closure, the monks at the monastery started selling pastéis de nata at a nearby sugar refinery to bring in revenue. In 1834, the monastery was closed, and the recipe was sold to the sugar refinery, whose owners in 1837 opened the fabrica, the Pastéis de Belém, where I was today. Apparently, Fran, the descendants still own the business to this day. The original recipe is kept in a secret room
out the back, and the shop now sells over 20,000 pastéis a day. Now, in that package, Fran, my original intention when I bought these pastéis de nata was to give them to riders and get them to do taste tests. Of course, riders are not going to eat that, certainly not before time trials. And I couldn't even, you know, Fran, these days, everyone I tried to give one to is on some kind of diet, was, you know, allergic to this or that. I mean, I'm as bad as everyone else because I said I don't really eat egg as well. So I ended up, Fran, having to use them to try and bribe press officers. I mean, we heard there from Stefan at Red Bull and Jacob at Little Trail. They were the only ones who would take the pastéis off my hands. Marijn Zeeman, he did take one for later. He was supposedly going to eat it later with Adi Engels, the other Visma Lisa bike.
Do you think he? Do you think he's eating it right now?
Well, as we heard earlier, it was it was kind of faux alarm. I don't think they were really worried and anxious. But when they heard that Machin at UAE had been eating, distributing this pastéis de nata, we talked about the rivalry between UAE and Visma Lisa bike. Now it's the pastéis de nata wars between those two teams. So that war is being fought on a new front now, Fran.
Man, but I am very curious to know what there is on this room on which they keep the recipe. I mean, is there just the recipe sitting in the middle of the room? Or there are more things around it, you know?
I would like to think so.
I mean, I would like...
In a case.
I mean, I think it would be even better if there were fridge, you know, and groceries and such, and then just the recipe hanging on a wall.
Maybe we should try and break in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have any projects for this evening? I don't,
Fran, back to the serious business of cycling. Marijn Zeeman, he is going to be a big loss for Visma Lisa bike, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's a brilliant, intelligent man. He has been a pretty empathic as well as emphatic on performance coach. He has managed to grow not only many individuals, but also an organization. I learned a lot from him when last year I had a long interview sitting down with him for an hour. I remember that some of the responses, some of the replies to my questions, I proposed to him to draw them instead of telling them, you know?
Draw them.
That's interesting. Yeah, because you know, there is this, unwritten, yet I read it, rule, which says that people can only keep full focus on a conversation or on a topic, for 21 minutes. So every time I do a long interview, I try to find manners, ways in order to interrupt the conversation and let the other person breathe, you know, and even myself. Sometimes I go buy a bottle of water, whatever, so they can get some space. And with Marijn, what I thought was, what if I bring a question, I can only think of one for him to draw the response. And in that case, it was a graph on which he had to draw which percentage of Visma's success was due to X different factors.
How did he react when you got out the sketchbook and the paints and the felt tip pens?
He loved it. Yeah. Wow. He actually enjoyed it and everything, you know, and it was a great conversation. Yeah. And in that conversation, for example, he told me something that I like it a lot, which is psychology is one of the main concerns. You know, it's the next big concern in professional cycling after once the nutrition shockwave is over. And I asked him how was he addressing that, the psychology topic, and what he said is that he had a psychology cabinet working for the team. But riders were not due to report to this cabinet. It was the DSs who had to. DSs and coaches had to have at least one monthly appointment in order to not only tell their stories, but also to get some strategies in order to deal with the athletes. And I found that very interesting because you were giving capacity to the people who was dealing with the athlete on the day-to-day.
I'm gonna throw the dictaphone, throw the voice recorder in the bin. I'm gonna have my sketchbook tomorrow. I'm gonna go going around the team buses distributing, yeah. You know.
Maybe we can
blank sheets of paper for people to, you know, just.
Have we ever produced a cycling podcast notebook?
No,
because
no.
Maybe that's the next merchandise that we should be giving away.
Fran, you're a fascinating man and an innovator as well. Let's talk about tomorrow's stage, shall we?
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Fran, la cena de ayer, yesterday's dinner. Have you eaten? Have you eaten well in Portugal?
I kind of enjoyed. Yesterday night I had an awfully late dinner with some colleagues and I had croquetas. I don't know how to translate it into English. You know,
so
what
we've
I
talked about croquetas before. I think people know what croquetas are.
So I had different type and sides of croquetas along with two April spritz. And it made for a nice dinner. As for lunch, I only have had salad because I am a very healthy guy, Daniel.
Mm.
What about you?
I had, as people are bored of hearing now on the podcast, I'm generally a vegetarian / vegan, except at bike races, because it's simply not very easy to be a vegan or vegetarian at bike races. So I've been eating meat here. I think they're called bochechas, which I think were like pork cheeks last night with arroz de alho, garlic rice, which was nicer than it sounds. But anyway, I think we've spoken enough about local delicacies or not tonight. Fran, let's talk about tomorrow's stage, shall we? Where do we start and where are we going?
So it's a 194-kilometer run from Cascais in the coast to Orem, which is a bit further inland. It comes across as a flat stage, yet the terrain in this area of Portugal is rather lumpy, and that makes for an elevation gain about 2,500 meters, which is not impressive, yet still significant. There are two Cat 4 climbs, one at the very start and the other one with 20 kilometers to go. Yet, the main attraction ahead of the finish line is the passage through Torres Vedras and Caldas da Rainha. I wonder, you know, why so?
Yes, Torres Vedras, after 67 kilometers, and that is the birthplace and the resting place of Joaquim Agostinho, the greatest Portuguese rider of all time, I would suggest, winner of multiple stages in the Tour de France, second place finish in the Vuelta a España in 1974, as discussed in our pre-race Kilometre Zero, April 1974. And after 111 kilometres, Fran, we are going through the birthplace of the present-day hero, João Almeida, and that's Caldas da Rainha. Da Rainha.
And the future hero as well, because Antonio Morgado from UAE Team Emirates also hails from Caldas da Rainha.
I don't know if there's anything planned specifically tomorrow, apart from sort of joyous scenes to greet the prodigious son returning. I spoke to his agent, Ken Sommer, earlier today and asked Ken if anything was planned. He wasn't aware of anything. Fran, I'm also quite excited about another location that we will visit tomorrow, or the race we'll visit, and that is Fatima, a very famous location. Oh, that's after 178 kilometers, so 16 kilometers from the finish. Fran, famous for a miracle. We heard me alluding to it in the interview with Luis Angel Mate earlier. I'll just explain what that miracle was. Beginning in spring of 1916, there were three Catholic shepherd children living near Fatima who reported apparitions of an angel, and they were visited by this angel supposedly, and they were told that various things were going to happen. The Virgin Mary was going to appear, and this would culminate in the Great War, the First World War ending. And she was very specific, this angel, and she said that on the 13th of every month for the next 6 months something was going to happen, something sort of, you know, supernatural was going to happen, and they claimed that these things were happening, and this thing sort of gathered momentum, and by the sixth month So on October the 13th of 1917, there were tens of thousands of people in Fatima waiting for this miracle, what came to be known as the miracle of the sun. And the sun, sure enough, did appear through dark clouds, and then it zigzagged apparently dramatically towards the earth, and then it zigzagged back up again to its original position. And witnesses reported that their previously wet clothes became suddenly completely dry, as well as the wet and muddy ground that had been previously soaked because of the rain that had been falling. And that was the miracle of the sun, and Fatima is still famous for that and still a place of pilgrimage for that. Fran, obviously there's quite a lot of skepticism about whether the sun did zigzag dramatically to the earth. And Fran, have you got, dare I ask you what your Fatima story is? Can we have a really, really brief version? Because I am slightly anxious about this.
Okay, so first things first, before becoming the awful human being I am now, I was a Catholic, you know, and I was raised in a Catholic school. I remember watching a 15-minute black and white film about the miracles of Fatima. Yeah, and then afterwards, when I was 15 or 16 years old, I got me and two other friends were invited to a camp in Fatima by the local priest, who was very good friends with us. We were play pool with him, you know. Yeah, so I went to this camp, and to my horror, it turned out to be an ultra Catholic camp, you know, on which we spent the whole day praying and worshiping things and such. And there my skepticism grew. I had many conversations with many different priests, and I remember one conversation at the very end of the camp.
Does the story end with you joining a Mexican cartel?
No, this story ends up with one of the priests saying to me, "You must find your faith."
And have you found your faith?
Well, I have a lot of faith. You've got a faith in people.
A lot of faith in João Almeida at this Vuelta a España.
For example, people like João Almeida makes me faithful. You know, but, my Catholic faith, I think it is somewhat lost, yet I still feel some energy accompanying me in my day to day. But that's a very deep subject of discussion.
Beautiful, you know? Philosophical, vaguely wistful note on which to end the story and to end tonight's podcast. Fran, I'm going to thank you. The view and the scene in front of us is even more beautiful now than it was when we started. Almost a full moon illuminating the night sky above Oeiras, the Portuguese flag fluttering from the medieval fortress which overlooks the Atlantic.
And in your back, you can see it, but on your back it's the sunset. So it's sunset color. So tell me if my dream came true. The dream I had this morning came true.
Tomorrow, who knows, maybe a miracle will come. Another miracle of the sun.
Victory by Luis Ángel Maté.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Free, and Lionel Byrne. Que nos vamos de aquí.